Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. And today I am joined by a special guest, Seth David Radwell. He is a business executive, both in books, including the electronic side of Scholastic, and a former CEO of the skincare business Proactive Company. He has an MA in public policy from Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And Seth is joining us today to discuss his upcoming book, American Schism, coming out on June 29 by Greenleaf Book Group Press. Seth, welcome to The Politics Guys.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And I wanted to start the show by saying how much I really enjoyed reading your book. You don't always get to choose who you're reading. I read a lot of things and some things you love and something. But I was really excited to be reading your book. I thought you had just kind of really an engaging style. I appreciated that. Before we get to that question, let's take a quick word from our sponsors. And so I wanted to start by putting your book in a nutshell. I'm going to kind of reverse the roles. I'm going to try to put your book in a nutshell, and then you be the professor and critique me. See how well that I do and tell me where I go wrong. So it seems that American Schism is about the current political divisions in the United States, and you think they're traced back to the Enlightenment. Specifically, your argument in American Schism is that it's the Enlightenment battle between what you label as the moderate and radical forces of the Enlightenment. And then you kind of bring in this third force, the counter-Enlightenment. And so you trace the history of this disagreement. And today in the United States, you think that our true rational debate is in America is actually connected to these early battles of intellectual thought embedded in the Enlightenment between these two groups, the moderate and the radicals. And so really our only hope to move forward is to kind of exit our thought bubbles and return to an agreement on rationality and to take up the questions of policy. Okay, so Seth, how would you grade me? Did I get your book pretty close? And what did I leave out? What should we include in there?
I mean, it actually was terrific, Trey. And I think it was a great nutshell summary. Sometimes the way I term it is, you know, we all talk today about how many of us are living in our own, you know, bubbles of reality and or political bubbles, if you will. And I think that is true. But we're also living in what I call a time bubble. In other words, we assume that all the debates that we have today, as crazy as they've become, are kind of frozen right now, while I'm pretty convinced they have antecedents and important roots in what actually created the founding of our country, going back to the Enlightenment. And that's why, to me, this investigative tracing back, I think, is so important in understanding and better appreciating where we are today.
So one of the things I'm always curious to push an author on, Seth, is to say, you know, writing a book of this size, writing a book of this scope, it's just a big investment. As a matter of fact, earlier you were telling me before the show aired that it was a 2.5-year process. And as a scholar, I understand that writing process. What was the impetus for you to undertake this project? What drove you to writing The American Schism?
Yeah, I mean, it has become almost an obsession and a labor of love and research. I've read hundreds of books and hundreds of articles as a process to get to this point of being able to pull together this book. Well, here's what I would say. It's actually interesting in the sense that, you know, I have roots in public policy because that's where what I studied in graduate school, and I've always my whole life I've been fascinated by kind of the public civic arena. But I built my career mostly in business over the last, 30 years, and I've run many successful consumer products companies. And so most of my a lot of my professional sphere are people who've run businesses or been in marketing. And to go back to your question, over the last couple of years, it was amazing to me. Two things happened. One was I noticed that most of my professional colleagues, be they traditional Republicans or Democrats, didn't matter. They were all were uncomfortable. They stopped wanting to talk about politics. It became a third rail to a degree that it had never been before. That was one thing I noticed. But probably more painful to me was the apparent disappearance of truth in the world. This notion of objective truth no longer being an appreciable value, that everybody seemed to have their own truths about it, almost everything. I call it in the book this lay postmodernism because, the postmodern philosophy of the past 50 years has been about the fluidity of things and the lack of objective truth. But I think it had gone to a new level. So here's what would happen. I would talk to friends, traditional, Republicans would often not want to get into it because they were torn about whether they were Trumpian or not. And my Democratic friends felt mostly incapable of dealing with what was happening to our republic and would put their head in the sand and not want to deal with it. And so the answer to your question is I felt that I really wanted to take this on because I felt like we had to, leaders of whatever sector, whether it's public or private, need to address this, need to reestablish a respectful way of talking to each other about civic issues. And it seemed to me that that had become entirely crowded out over the last couple of years. Not only in the Trump years, but even before, but it had gone to a level where, respectful dialogue grounded in reason had been crowded out by this concept of kind of political identity shouting on both the left and the right. And so, what I was committed to do was, again, to do this investigative tracing of where our differences come from without necessarily coming from either a left or right perspective, but a historical one.
I really loved that, and I'm glad you start there because I think that really comes out at the beginning of your book. As a matter of fact, to kind of put my own bias out there, because one of the things we do on the Politics Guys is try to have those rational disagreements. And one of the ways we do that is by being upfront about our starting points. So one of the things I was really happy to see too, intellectually, was your defense of the Enlightenment. I saw that. I don't think we get enough of that in contemporary American politics or American culture. And I especially liked your pushbacks, as you were even kind of indicating there, against postmodernism and even later some Marxist critiques of the Enlightenment. As a matter of fact, I'll be open here. My middle son's name is Samuel Locke. And so he's Samuel after the Christian Old Testament or the Jewish scriptures, but he's Locke actually after John Locke because Locke's
Sure.
writing is one of the big reasons I'm a political scientist. So you might imagine I'm a little biased about the importance of the Enlightenment and rationality. So what I'd like you to kind of start to do is, I'm easy on this front, but make a defense for that because today the Enlightenment doesn't have as many defenders. So.
Right. Well, that's such a. I'm so glad you brought that up, Trey, because to me, it's fascinating. First of all, if you look at the news today or watch what's going on in the world, it seems that every day we're on the brink of catastrophe. There's always some doomsday thing happening, whether it's COVID or climate change or crime. But I think to really understand why the Enlightenment is so vital for the modern society, you have to take a little bit of a longer term perspective. So in the, like, let's look in the past 200 years, human civilization has made more progress in prosperity than in the prior 2000 years. And that's based on some good objective facts. That's not an opinion. For example, in the last 200 years, life expectancy has gone from 31 years to over 70 years. So we're living much longer. 200 years ago, one in five children born did not survive to age five. Today, almost all do. 200 years ago, four-fifths of the world lived in poverty. Today, one-fifth of the world does. So when you look at the slightly longer-term perspective, we've made tremendous prosperity flourish in the human civilization. Now, much of this is due, in my view, to the Enlightenment, to this new way of thinking that embraced the human potential for rational understanding, for empirical observation, all the things that came out of the Enlightenment. So to answer, I think the Enlightenment is so vital to modern society that the numbers speak for themselves. When you look at the stat, and I'm not just talking about in the U.S., those are statistics all over the globe, about four-fifths of the world living in poverty 200 years ago versus one-fifth today. So there's been tremendous progress in human prosperity because of the Enlightenment. Now, what's happened in the last 50 years is there's been this critique of the Enlightenment because it was mostly put forth by white European males. And that's true. That's definitely an important thing to take into account, that there was that there may have been certain perspectives, and this is true of all history, of course. You know, history is written by the winners. So the Enlightenment has been under assault really since over 50 years. It used to be 50, 60 years ago, back in before the 1950s, it was generally recognized that the Enlightenment was what was behind the forming of the United States, the French Revolution. I mean, most of the major creations of modern society were due to the Enlightenment. Then 50 years ago, the Enlightenment became under assault by what we now call postmodernism, this notion that the Enlightenment only affected, certain aspects of society, and that not everybody read Locke like you did or I did. And, I think the important point of the postmodern movement was the recognition that it was important to incorporate other perspectives into historical philosophy or historical thinking. And that's certainly true. And whether those are, other perspectives based on culture or race or gender, all of that is important. But what I think ended up happening over the last 60 years is that we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Of course, the Enlightenment was mostly influenced by people, just learned people in society at that time, which were mostly, not all, but mostly men. But that doesn't mean that what they worked on it and put forth wasn't fundamentally, a revolutionary notion of human progress based on rationality and reason. I mean, the Enlightenment was an embrace of the human potential after thousands of years of that not being a focus, where most of the realm was in the spiritual or religious world. So I hope that summarizes why I think the Enlightenment is so important. And there's no question in my mind, I think it's not debatable, that it was the Enlightenment that motivated our founders, both those that I describe on the radical side and on the moderate side.
And I want to get to that radical and moderate in a minute, but there was a couple of things there that I thought were important about your response. And one of those is you kind of talk about the origins of the Enlightenment. And, you can have a critique of that without throwing all of it out. And even at the time, one of the elements that it was important for me, authors such as Mary Wollstonecraft, who effectively argued that the Enlightenment should be expanded to women. In other words, that it hadn't happened at the time. Yeah. I had wondered, and you have this very kind of detailed work, but there are some other Enlightenment kind of outsiders like Wollstonecraft. Was there a reason for not including some of those kinds of early Enlightenment non-white males who were early pushing for that? Because it kind of seems to fit into your argument.
It does. And in fact, I do mention Wells and Crafted at a couple of points, but it's certainly not a focus. Another example that I was thinking about going into more detail in the book was Sophie Condorcet, who was the wife of Condorcet, the French radical. So there was certainly women who were involved. And over the course of the, I think I discussed in the book that, you know, over the course of the Second Great Awakening, women, one of the benefits of that movement, although it was fundamentally spiritual, was that women became to have more of a voice in the American political sphere. So I think to answer your question, the why, I mean, I didn't have the purpose of the book wasn't a detailed review of philosophy. I was trying to use a couple of the key leaders of the moderate and radical movements to articulate for the layperson, for the professional philosopher or historian, what the differences between those schools were. So it was natural that I kind of, as examples, I used kind of the what I would call the most well-known those voices that contributed the most. So on the moderate side, those would be the Locke and Rousseau, and John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. And on the radical side, a lot of the French radicals and people like Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson.
And, you know, that's always a difficult line to walk. I mean, you know, when you're trying to both write something that is intellectual and thoughtful, but you're simultaneously trying to not write just the entire academic tome, you know, that's a tough place to be. And I do want to say there that I thought that you walked that line well. I was just a little curious about some of those others who might have made that broader point you were making. Now, another one that I want to hit it here is I thought one of, and you start off with it, and that's why I wanted to ask a question early about it. Early on, you make kind of this bold prescription, and you're going to repeat that. You start with it, and then later in your conclusion, you come back to it, is this idea that the only hope for our for kind of rectifying the schism in the United States is to fight, in your words, the growing cancer of unreason with reason. And, yes. You know, I think that's this wonderful aspirational ideal. But, yeah, here's the but. As a political communications scholar, you know, there's a lot of us who are going to be really skeptical of that claim, especially in communication, where we see that reason doesn't always come out the way that we think it will. As a matter of fact, in a lot of ways, humans don't act reasonably in communication contexts. So just like in economics, oftentimes we see the prescription that bad money drives out good money. Why wouldn't we posit that unreason will drive out reason? So, you know, kind of defend that bold prescription. How can we reason with the unreasonable?
I would say it's a great question, and it's one of the most enigmatic parts of the book. But let me say that public discourse over the course of hundreds of years have always been a combination of rational arguments and emotional or unreasoned, if you will, feelings and sentiments. That's always been the case. My point is that partially due to the nature of media today and other factors as well, which we'll get to, it's become crowded out. In other words, the blend of reason and emotion has become tilted to such a degree to the unreasonable that we have no space left for rational problem solving. Let me explain why I think that's happened, because I think this is important. You know, we often hear the terms of, you know, identity politics and tribal politics. What I think is really being described by those terms is the following phenomena. You know, as the human species over millions of years have developed important survival mechanisms related to in-group and out-group responses. And it's for our survival, you know, again, eons ago, it was important to have these amygdala-driven responses to folks who would protect us as in-group members and folks we needed to be wary of as out-group members. I mean, we all know that those are primitive drives, because if we're at all involved in rooting for sports teams, we feel that. You feel that adrenaline, that push. And it's a wonderful thing, because, again, these are natural human drives from our ancestry. So it's a wonderful thing to express in the sports arena, but it's not the best for creating public policy. And I think what happens now is that that's what gets triggered, those amygdala-driven forces, whether it's through social media or even, you know, cable news media, in order to fulfill the incentive business model, which is to get people to watch, it's much easier to trigger those responses than thoughtful dialogue. And this is not, again, this is not new, Trey. It's not like it just happened over the course of the last couple of years. It's been progressing that way. And I think we have to be conscious of it. So, for example, I'll try to, when I hear, whether it's on the left or right, arguments that are made which are ridiculing the other side, whether it's people on the left demonizing Trump followers or whether it's people on the right demonizing, you know, Pelosi or the socialists, I always stop them. And I, you know, because I think that notion of characterization of the other point of view and ridiculing it is what we have to reject. And so that would be like one example of being conscious of the fact that it's, even though it may feel good to you know, battle the other side with ad hominem attacks, that's not going to help advance the discussion. Hmm. So I'm very much in any political dialogue, I really am about respecting and appreciating different points of view. As I say to colleagues on both sides of the aisle, I don't care what your political beliefs are. I'm open to talking about this if you're willing to have a rational discussion. As soon as you start moving to where emotions are driving the overall discussion into unreasonable territory, where you're not embracing facts and data, that's where I think the conversation devolves.
I love to hear you say that, because one of the strengths, I think, of your book, as you put it there, is I want to have a conversation, but I want to have that conversation rationally, because that's the way we stop that's the way that we end up stopping that tribal attack, right? That, you know, where we're right, you're wrong. And I loved that, but there was a few places in your book where it kind of seemed like maybe you hedged your bet on that more than kind of what you're saying here. So I'm kind of curious to talk about that for just a second. And sure. The area specifically in the book that I was curious about is you talk about how objectivity and science and objectivity and political philosophy are these two separate things. And it seems like you want to give some space for postmodernism in the political philosophy or in the humanities. Maybe I'm pushing back on that a little bit, or maybe I'm asking you a little bit here to kind of say why, because so how do we have the hard sciences, as you put it, if we don't have an objective philosophy of science? And if we can have that objective philosophy of science to say chemicals, and to climate change, why can't we have that philosophy of science in my area of discipline, right? Power and human behavior. So were you intending to have that kind of hedge there? Am I reading that correctly? And if so, why?
I think it's an important distinction, though, between the sciences, where there is such a thing as provable objective truths, and going back to, you know, from mathematics on, to social sciences, where there's more, there is by definition more fluidity in viewpoints. Now, I will say that if you're a pure postmodernist, would say that no objective truth exists at all. Hmm. That even things like mathematics and science are constructs of society, and you know, it goes to the point of there's no fluidity in truth. I mean, there's no objectivity in truth. There's no such thing as gender. There's no such thing as everything is fluid. And I think that is misguided. I think the intent of the postmodern movement was to incorporate and be aware of bias and incorporate other perspectives. So especially in the social sciences, I think that there are truths there still is data. As you know, I'm sure a lot of the research that you do, Trey, you use data. But then there's the interpretation of the data. And in the social sciences, it's not that there isn't truth. It's the truth is facts. We interpret that truth based on our own potentially bias or other political beliefs, and that's where the line is a bit fuzzy. And well, so if we, but if, Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Please finish that thought. I thought you were paused. Continue.
Just that if we spend all our time in the social sciences debating what is fact versus not, then we'll never get there. So in other words, I would make the argument that what's going on in Arizona today about like this search for fraud in the election the 17th time, this is a case where we're not accepting the data. The data are clear, but somehow we're trying to find some other truth. And to me, that is a microcosm of this problem. Before I finish the thought, the one thing I want to just also mention is that it is interesting that in some ways, the field that you know you and I are in whether it's humanities or economics or folks who are in the hard sciences tend to be very comfortable with hard lines between truth and interpretation. And in the soft sciences, I think the line is fuzzier. Go ahead, but I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. You were not. I had interrupted you, so I appreciate that thoughtful response. And I, you know, one of the things, and maybe this is my own academic high horse, but I'm always cautious about that kind of distinction that you're drawing. I think really that the difference there isn't so much that there is more interpretation in the social sciences, but rather because we're dealing with people, we apply morality to that. And so a lot of times for my intro students, you know, we'll take a look at data and I'll ask them what the data means. And what they're really doing is they're taking a look at the data and then they're superimposing it on that. A moral position on top of it. And so that's why I was kind of pushing on that a little bit, because I'm always worried that if we give in to the thought that the social sciences can't be rational, if it can't be objective, that we end up undoing that enlightenment project. And so that, you know, that was part of it. Because as you note, you know, democracy is only going to work if we have kind of objective truth. But of course, that's going to mean objective truth in the political sphere. So that's why I was interested about that.
I think your point's very valid. And certainly that's what you find when you really understand what the Enlightenment's contributions were in the area of political philosophy. Because, of course, there's by definition, there was some hierarchy of values. You know, for Locke, whether it was, you know, liberty and property rights, or whether it was for in Condorcet's world or in some of the French radicals, whether it was much more about the right for access to opportunity, there was certainly a hierarchy of values that was overlaid on top of the data.
Now, I do, because, you know, I love this conversation about, you know, the Enlightenment rationality, but I also want to get to this key distinction. You've talked about it several times, and it's a key distinction for your whole argument. It's a key distinction for the American Schism, for the book. And that is that the Enlightenment is not primarily defined by geography. And, you know, for listeners, you kind of go through the book and many might know this. But one of the ways you can kind of slice, there's a lot of ways you can slice up the Enlightenment. But one common way is to do it by geography. Where were they? What was the kind of the country of origin? You argue rather that we need to think of the Enlightenment as really having two major camps. The moderate Enlightenment theorists and the radical theorists. And so the moderate Enlightenment theorists are almost kind of quasi-conservative in your view, because they're willing to live in a non-pure democracy and they have a focus on property rights over other kinds of important rights. Now, I was a little surprised to find that you put Locke in that group, but we'll put that aside for a minute, because one of the things I noticed was while you mentioned most of the major Enlightenment theorists as being moderate. So since the radicals play such a crucial portion later in your book, that's the side that you side with, I would love to know who are the radicals that we should be looking at and what distinguishes the radical theorists from their opponents in the Enlightenment?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I need to mention that this framework of moderate and radical is not something I invented.
Another author.
One of the foremost scholars of the Enlightenment is a guy named Jonathan Israel, and who was at Oxford and then and Princeton, and he's written many academic books on this, and I've read most of them. And so his framework is very much this notion of the Enlightenment being distinguished by these two schools. So what I would say is that, you know, in fact, I 2 years ago, I got in touch with him and explained that I thought a lot of his framework of this moderate versus radical was extremely relevant for what was happening in the U.S. And I discussed with him the notion of adapting his framework to do an investigative analysis of the American schism. So, you know, which of course he was very supportive of. He ended up writing, I think, you know, the intro.
Yes. Yes.
So let's talk about this distinction and why it's so important, because I think it's fundamental. The easiest way to think about it is that, you know, most of the moderates, and these are a lot of the big names we know, Voltaire, Rousseau, Locke, they were in a complete sense, Enlightenment figures in that they embrace science and rationality, and they recognize that the civic governing mechanisms of the past hundreds of years had been dominated by a situation that created oppression and left most humans in misery. But the moderate solution was fundamentally for people who were enlightened, educated like themselves, to step up and control the abusive powers like monarchy and the nobility. So their prescription was for enlightened leadership. And the difference between them and the radicals were the radicals believed that the only way to sustain a more just society, which that wasn't abusive, where people weren't abused by the people who were powerful based on the birth lottery, whether they were kings or noblemen or whatever. The only way to do that was to have a representative democracy where all people participate. And whereas the moderates felt that because so much of the world at that time, 250 years ago, were uneducated, there was no possible way the average person could advocate for their own interests. They didn't know what their interests were. So it was the responsibility of what today we would call the elite to govern. Now, so one key difference between the two schools is the radicals really embrace the notion of representative democracy. The second important distinction, as I describe in the book, is that the radicals wrote a lot about how for centuries they described this collusion between the church and the monarchy and nobility to work together to keep people in place, so to speak, keep people in their social status that they were born into. And they viewed that as a collusion because both those sectors of society, the clergy and the nobility, were privileged and had most of the spoils, if you will. And so because the radicals were so interested and investigative for how this evolved, they prescribed that it was fundamentally important that in the civic arena there be a separation of church and state. In other words, many of the radicals may have been spiritual and religious. Some were deists, which I'll get into in a minute, and some were probably atheists. But they certainly believed that even if you were religious, they recognized that the spiritual world needed to be separate from the civic world, whereas the moderates really embraced the role of the church. In fact, Voltaire, who's one of the classic moderates, had a very interesting quote, which I won't say it in French, but in English it is, If God didn't exist, we would have to invent him.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that we need the church to keep to foster morality, to keep people on the straight line, so to speak. So the moderates very much, in the most part, condoned the church's role in civic society, whereas the radicals, and notably this would be Jefferson in the U.S., was so passionate about the need to separate church from state that he famously said, you know, the United States is not only about freedom of religion, it's freedom from religion. So that's some of the examples of the key differences between the moderates and the radicals. Now, if you want to talk about specific names, I mean, in the U.S., you know, John Adams would be a great example of a moderate. I mean, he was a very aristocratic gentleman who was very learned. And he never believed in democracy. In fact, the moderates eschewed democracy. They felt that there was no way that the average people could govern themselves. So government of the people was very troublesome in the sense that the word democracy at that time had a negative connotation. It meant demagogues. The fear on the moderates' part was that people who weren't educated could be so easily influenced by someone in a demagogic sense purporting to be advocating for the people's interests, but was really conniving and treacherous.
So, because that view goes all the way back to the idea of kind of Aristotle and the framers' focus and thought on kind of Roman republican systems. You're absolutely right. I agree.
Right, exactly. And so they were very concerned. And so for people like John Adams, and one of the great examples, of course, is Alexander Hamilton, because Alexander Hamilton, while not born elite, he was a genius, and he became a defender or a promoter of what I call the competence model. He knew that creating a workable republic was so complicated that he thought the only way to achieve it is to put the best minds in society at the task. And so for Hamilton, it wasn't so much that he didn't believe people should have fundamental rights, but he believed that only the competent could really govern. But the Adams and Hamilton coalition of this competence, more aristocratic elite model, which ultimately they brought Washington to their side, was in fact the raison d'etre of the Federalist Party, which was, of course, one of our founding early political movements in the U.S. And on the other side, you had what became the Democratic Republicans, people like Jefferson, Thomas Paine, and Benjamin Franklin. And they're all interesting in their own right. But famously, Thomas Paine thought that by the time we got to the Constitution in 1789, that it was a complete a surrender to the power of the old regime, in that it didn't give people rights. It didn't really advocate for a representative democratic system where people had a voice in government. From Thomas Paine's perspective, it wasn't a government of the people. And Benjamin Franklin felt the same. Jefferson is more complicated because Jefferson, as we know, is one of history's most enigmatic figures for a whole bunch of reasons. But fundamentally, Jefferson's vision as an idealist, and I've read some of the great biographies of Jefferson by the Jeffersonian scholars, but I don't purport to be a Jeffersonian scholar myself. So, you know, it's always a tricky, but I mean, Jefferson was an idealist who believed in the notion of complete decentralization of power, that his model was this agrarian state where everyone had access to their own ability to create a life, prosperity that was unfettered by political forces from some distant, faraway place. And that, be it England or Old Britain, or be it, the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so it was the decentralization of power, the freedom from government, from religion, that was the motivating force for Jefferson and many of his Democratic Republicans.
Now, I love that you're kind of connecting that also with the American individuals that you see as latching on to or being an extension of the moderate and the radical visions of the Enlightenment. But there's a third group that is important in the narrative of your book, and that comes important, especially in terms of talking about the era of Trump, and that's the counter-Enlightenment. And you spend some time with that. It's kind of backlash historically, but I want to focus here a little bit because you've even moved that direction to look at it. And you see the counter-Enlightenment in the United States kind of springing forth historically from the Second Great Awakening. And ultimately, I think that you're kind of drawing a line and saying that counter-Enlightenment can explain some of the things about Trump and the 2016 through 2021.
Right.
I was drawn to that part of your book, Seth, in part because, my own religious background comes from that era, right? So I'm part of the Restoration Movement, which that's the original origins of Oklahoma
right.
Christian University. So this is, so Jefferson in this era is really important for me. So what makes the Counter-Enlightenment so important? And in what ways, and do you really think that Trumpism can be traced to that kind of 1804 era of kind of pushing back against the era of Enlightenment thinking during the framing?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And I think the counter-Enlightenment has been a force in American society ever since the founding. In other words, it wasn't only in Trumpian years that counter-Enlightenment forces became quite dominant. The way I describe it in the book is the counter-Enlightenment kind of overlaid on top of this radical moderate split with unpredictable effects. And the irony, of course, is that during our founding was probably the period of American history that was the most secular, because most of the founders, whether they were moderate or radical, tended to be advocates for separating religion from the civic arena, Washington as well. So what do I mean by the counter-Enlightenment? First of all, the counter-Enlightenment it's not a pejorative term. Although sometimes it comes across that way because when it's explicitly rejecting rationality. So the counter-Enlightenment is probably best first understood as counter-movement to the Enlightenment back in the 18th century. So after the Enlightenment exploded in Europe and in the United States, the forces that were most threatened, notably the church and the powerful, the nobility, many members of the aristocracy and nobility, they pushed back in various ways. One of the ways that they fought the Enlightenment movement was by insisting that faith was really the driver of human society. Faith is what separated humans from the beast, so to speak. And faith has played a huge important role in American society over the centuries, and in many ways has been incredibly positive. If you look at the influence of churches over in local society, it's incredible how much good they've done. And of course, there also are a lot of negative consequences of the power of religion in our society. But the point being is that the counter-Enlightenment, whether it's back during in the communist years when, you know, Billy Graham famously associated American democratic freedom with evangelical Christianity, which was, I think, the beginning of the kind of more modern evangelical movement, or back, as I referred to, the Second Great Awakening, where Americans were searching for a new spirituality as different sects of Protestantism became quite prevalent during that period. It had huge benefits in that it brought women into the civic discussion, because women were playing a large role at first in the Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, by getting involved in their communities and speaking up against things like slavery or famously temperance, because there was abuse of alcohol to a great degree in the 1800s. And so women spoke about the temperance movement. My point being is that the counter-Enlightenment had some tremendously beneficial effects. And I think that in that sense, faith has been a huge motivator of a lot of good in society. But when it goes to a point where the counter-Enlightenment is articulating a position that's against reason or rejecting reason altogether, as it has at various points in our society, and I would argue certainly in recent years in the Trump era, that's happened more frequently, then I think the counter-Enlightenment becomes non-productive or destructive, if you will. And so I think that it's really important to pay attention to these counter-Enlightenment forces, which can be of many different sorts, and what effect they're having on our civic debate.
A very thoughtful answer. I want to touch on that just a little bit more. There's kind of two areas I want to touch on here. And one of those is I deeply agree with kind of the bottom line outcome that you're getting there at, in that, and I agreed as I was reading, and that I think that often that evangelical Christians have imposed their particular view of Christianity on the framers. And you even kind of talk about the symbolism in the book. You didn't get that to your answer. We'll save that for you. But I think that kind of plays into your answer here, you know, Washington, yes, bringing down, you know, the law, the Constitution. Yeah.
Right.
But I wonder a little bit here.
It's probably important for you to listen. Go ahead.
Oh, say that one more time. I'm so sorry, Seth.
I was going to say before, I mean, that's such a vivid, I'm glad you brought it up. It's sort of like there's this aspect of the Second Great Awakening that's really important that you mentioned, which is was recasting the history of the U.S. in spiritual terms. And mm-hmm. that famous painting you're referring to is a parallel to God handing the tablets to Moses, which is this godlike figure handing the Constitution down to Washington. And that image became a kind of a revisionist version of our founding. But the reason why it's so important today to think to mention that, I'm so glad you brought it up, Trey, is that the framers meant for our Constitution to be malleable, to change with the times. So the notion of God handing it down like the law is completely contrary to that. I think to some degree, I mean, the last time we amended the Constitution was in the 70s. You know, we've somehow believed that the Constitution is God's word. And that would be an example, I'm so glad you brought that up, of where a counter Enlightenment impulse is really inhibiting progression.
Well, and that's where I wanted to get to, because, you know, one view of that era, and you don't quite seem to hit this, so I'm kind of curious to see what you'll say. You know, you kind of put the Declaration of the Independence and the Constitution into a singular bucket that are about the Enlightenment. But in an alternative view argues that in many ways, the Declaration of Independence is in fact the true expression of Enlightenment thinking, and that the Constitution is it's not exactly a complete counter, but it's a conservative response to what they saw as the overreach of that Jeffersonian Enlightenment-laced. I mean, Locke's writing is in large part the inspiration for the Declaration of Independence. You take out the word property and you put in the in pursuit of happiness and you go from Locke to Jefferson. So what do you say about this idea that perhaps part of what explains this is the fact that the Constitution itself might be a bit of a conservative reaction to the Enlightenment? Would you agree with that? Does that fit into your argument here in the book? But before you answer, we're just going to take a quick break, Seth, for a few words from our sponsor.
Yes, I mean, 100%. And the way I frame it in the book, although maybe it doesn't come across as much as it should, is that the Declaration of Independence, the spirit of 76, was all about an idealist notion of breaking away and achieving freedom and liberty. It was about breaking bonds. The Declaration of Independence was a radical Enlightenment document, whereas the Constitution was much more of a conservative compromise. And the way I describe it in the book is that the era of the spirit of 76 was about breaking away and achieving liberty, breaking away from Britain. But what happened soon after the war ended was that the American founders had to build a government. They had to figure out what 13 colonies that had separate ethos and culture, how are they going to work together and have a foreign policy? How are they going to pay for the war? So there was a bunch of practical concerns that became extremely important in the period after 1776 through the writing of the Constitution, which is what led to a lot of the compromises that ultimately resulted. I mean, James Madison, who is the primary author of the Constitution, although, of course, the convention had many voices, and Alexander Hamilton was equally important, I think, in devising kind of the system of a federal government, ended up requiring enormous compromises that moved the framework, if you will, closer to what would be considered a moderate Enlightenment stance. What do I mean by that? Well, it doesn't have, while there are elements of representative democracy, although of course it was for white men with property at the time, the Constitution is far from a egalitarian democracy. Senators were not, the president was elected by senators. Senators really were not elected from the people, but from state houses. So there was evidence in the Constitution of a much more moderate view. And that became a consequence of this need for compromises that the moderates really inserted into the process. So going to your question overall, I agree with the Declaration was this radical Enlightenment ideal. And the Constitution was the first real attempt to make it come to reality, to execute the ideal. And invariably, there's messiness in the details. So the execution was quite complex. And I think what happened between 1776 and 1789 was that all these pressing problems required solutions. And as we often say, the adage says, there's 1,000 critics for every playwright. All of a sudden, we had to build something anew. And it required these compromises to work. And that's where the pragmatists like Hamilton ended up becoming so important, fighting against the idealists like Jefferson. Now, Madison in many ways was the architect of the Constitution that tried to thread the needle, if you will, and balance both sides. But the Constitution would never have been ratified had it not been for the Bill of Rights, which was trying to correct for the fact that, to use your term, Trey, the Constitution was too conservative. It didn't uphold the spirit of the Declaration, which is why the Bill of Rights ended up becoming the way to ensure that it still had that 1776 promise. But there are obvious things in the Constitution that are contrary to the spirit of the Declaration.
And therefore the radical Enlightenment. Well, and right. Part of that, I saw that you had mentioned earlier Jefferson, another near and dear for me. You know, Jefferson himself argued that we effectively had two revolutions, that we had the 1776, but then you have the second revolution in 1800 when he comes to power, and we're going to kind of undo some of that conservatism, or maybe, as you were putting it, that threading of the needle, that pragmatism that perhaps had a conservative bent. And so I kind of wonder, do you see that as being maybe a potential promise that can move in that direction because of Jeffersonian? Again, you mentioned him a little bit more in your answers as we've been talking. I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, there's two things I would say. It's fascinating. The real failure of Jefferson's presidency was not to figure out a way to abolish slavery, which had, you know, the founders always thought that slavery would go away somehow. And they kind of punted on the issue, recognizing how counter-Enlightenment the whole concept of slavery was. And of course, the irony being that Jefferson and many others were slave owners. But famously, you know, when it came, even though Jefferson had abolished the international slave trade, which was allowed only a certain number of years after the Constitution was written, he ultimately allowed slavery to be extended to the Louisiana territories. And so in that sense, I think it was really one of those pivotal moments when what had become institutionalized and solidified, this horrific institution was inextricably linked to the American identity. And that's why also, by the way, just going back to the importance of the Declaration, what Lincoln was so brilliant at Gettysburg was his description of the fact that the Constitution as it was didn't fulfill the promise of the Declaration and therefore needed to be amended. And so what Lincoln did with kind of his eloquence was to raise the preeminence of the Declaration as the creed of America and the Constitution as merely an attempt at its execution. So I think, you know, you've got to look at the Jeffersonian presidency, which was fascinating in its own right because it failed on many levels in that early part of the 19th century, but that which of course led up to many trends. One of which was Jacksonian populism, and ultimately to the Civil War.
Now, I want to continue to move us forward because, you know, we don't want to spend all of our time in any one part of your book because it is you know, worthy to get to your prescriptions as you move forward. And so I love how you're kind of tracing these lines. Now we've been talking about it in terms of the era of the framers. How does these camps and the Enlightenment and the counter-Enlightenment fit into the constitutional framework and then moving forward? And part of what your later theme is, and we mentioned this earlier, was this idea that we have to return to rationality by returning to the objective, returning to the facts. And so there were a couple of spots later where I was scratching my head a little bit. I was actually going to ask the question one way, but you kind of almost agreed with me in the introduction. So I'm really curious about this now, is that you mentioned, for example, that the data, you say later, is that the United States is becoming a plutocracy because both parties have kind of aligned around neoliberal or globalist outcomes. And in your terms, the data, as you say, quote, the data clearly demonstrates a worsening conditions for people in that measure. And I was actually going to kind of push back a little bit and say, well, but there's a lot of ways in which people are doing much better off. But you started the show by that. So I was a little bit curious then. I wasn't expecting you to take that track at the beginning of the show. How do you reconcile then? I mean, obviously we agreed on the data after all, right? You know, life expectancy right. going up, extreme poverty has gone down. All of these measures show that, as a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons I think the Enlightenment does well. So this portion of the book struck me as a little unusual that you spent so much time talking about this kind of the problems of globalization is forcing people into poverty. It seemed a little counterintuitive to me. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, so from an economics perspective, it's actually and it's quite interesting. I mean, I think in some ways the real winners of globalization were you know, millions, if not billions, of poor people, like, for example, all over Asia, who now are earning a living income. But in relative sense, some of the losers were working class people in the United States, because they didn't, in the last 50 years, they netted about the same. They didn't get ahead as much as the wealthy or, let's say, the extremely poor in other mm-hmm. parts of the world. And that's a lot due to globalization. But so without getting into the kind of the nutty economics, macro yeah. and microeconomics, what's happened, I think the point is that whenever in the U.S., whenever too much power accrues to the wealthy, their interests diverge from that of the mass population. I mean, and that's kind of we've been increasingly heading toward that point over the last 30 years as the distribution of wealth in the country has become more and more tilted. And by the way, as you know, having read the book, I'm a complete believer in capitalistic meritocracy. I'm not arguing for some kind of a quality of outcome system. But that being said, I think as more power accrues to the very wealthy, their interests diverge from most citizens. They become less interested in democracy because they want to hold on to their power, and they become less interested in providing some notion of equality of opportunity to the masses. And I think we're at that point. This happened, by the way, before the Progressive Era, which is what led to the Progressive Era in the early part of the 20th century, was the realization that big business, and whether it was steel barons or railroads, had accumulated too much power, and there needed to be controls that ensured that there was access to some of the public goods in society, information that the government could provide. And so, you know, I go into the book in some detail about, in a capitalist system, what in fact the role of government is, which I believe is very specific, but it's certainly. Part of it is certainly to ensure access to equality of opportunity, and education would be a great example of that. Like, going back to the French radicals, they recognized how important education was if they were going to fulfill their vision for a representative democracy. A democracy requires an educated populace. Well, one could argue that over the last 30 years, access to quality education in the U.S. has declined precipitously. This has been written about from many of the current writers writing about meritocracy, whether it's the Meritocracy Trap by Markowitz or other books that describe that, you know, what we currently have in the U.S. is a far cry from a true meritocracy in the sense of providing equal opportunity. So that's why I think this movement towards a plutocracy is very dangerous. And I think one of the great examples that I think of an issue that was you know, misguided was the Citizens United case, which gives like unlimited power to corporations, which corporations, as we know, is basically a construct that was created for liability and tax issues. But the notion of corporations having the right to free speech, I think, is a stretch.
So I appreciate what you say there in your answer. And part of what you answered there, Seth, and that you get again into your book a lot, is you're talking about the importance of education. And I'm very sympathetic on that front. As a matter of fact, I might be even a little more radical than you on that one, in the sense that I really do think that one of the key elements here is a civic education. I don't think we get a lot of a civic education. I can't tell you how many students, freshmen who come in, and I've taught all across the country, and they don't even have kind of the basics down of how the system works. But of course, another way that we get at that civic education is through engagement in society, that kind of civic community. Yeah. And that's another element that you talk about in the book. You argue that globalization has also, not only has it kind of has created that plutocracy, as you were talking about, but it's also created a loss of civic community in America. Now, there is a counter thesis to this, and I didn't see you attack this. I was kind of curious what your thought on this was. Of course, the other potential reason for the decline of civic community, and this is an argument that comes from Robert Putnam, famously in Bowling Alone, was that it's not money or inequality that ended these civic institutions, because, of course, they were strong during some of our frequent times of inequality during the Depression, for example. But instead, it is really around the design of our entertainment and around the design of our social institutions, the way we interact. So we don't have the Rotary Club because we don't get together with people. We hang out on the internet and watch Marvel movies ad nauseum on Disney Plus. Although, and then Putnam was just talking about television, but we've taken it forward since then. So right. What do you kind of argue to those scholars? Because that is a big claim there, that say, well, really, it's more about that kind of communication. And again, we'll want to bring that up again, because communication plays a role in the end of your book as well. So what do you say to kind of the Putnam scholars who say, well, I agree with you, but I don't know if it's necessarily globalization. It's really kind of these media problems that create a lack of civic institutions.
Well, there's no question that interaction, social interaction in the digital sphere is quite different than it is in person. And so I think there's, you know, Putnam's case is strong in that regard, especially when you extend it to where we are today. The group More in Common has done a lot of research that shows that, so that 77% of Americans believe are part of what they call the exhausted majority, meaning that they're tired of the left and right screaming at each other. But it turns out that that they've done research that shows that when people have physical interaction in a room or in a public space, or there's a much greater sense of understanding the other point of view and empathy than there is based on digital interaction alone. So I guess there's no question that element, which is isolationist or is inhibiting true human interaction, is definitely a cause of some of our ills. But that being said, there's no question that some of globalization that has devastated certain parts of our country. So I guess the point about globalization is that it was so unequal. It's helped cities, but rural areas and non-urban areas across the country have been so devastated by the loss of manufacturing as we move to a service economy that a lot of what people in those societies remember as being vibrant about their childhoods, whether it was Memorial Day parades down Main Street, or whether it was different civic arena clubs, or even churches and institutions, many of those have gone away because of this incredible economic hardship. And it's not only in the civic arena. I mean, many small towns that had their own church or denomination, because of economic realities, the church may have closed, and combined with another parish or another church somewhere else in a place that's further away from their town. So there's been a tremendous depression, if you will, or economic hardship has unequally affected rural America. And so I think that was the argument that I was trying to make for why globalization has you know, had such a negative effect on the current economic reality of opportunity or access to opportunity in today's America.
Now, and from all that, your argument then progresses to say that Trump, what he was effectively able to do, what makes it seem surprising, but yet shouldn't be, is that he was able to use these true disparities, this true objective impoverishing, and use it for his advantage. And as a matter of fact, you seem to have a kind of a critique for the left on this front, in the sense that they aren't willing to recognize the actual underlying problem there, and therefore that's why kind of Trump could create these wedge issues. So talk a little bit here, because you do spend a lot of time on Trump. So how do these structural problems lead to the wedging, as you put it, of Trump?
Well, what started to happen over the course of the last 30 years is both political parties, both mainstream parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, left out the working class American rural voter and didn't address their needs. I mean, one of the great examples of it, I mean, the traditional Republican Party, which became a party of the wealthy and different factions, but a lot of the wealthy. But the Democratic Party became the party of the kind of the educated technocrats and urban centers, and left out the working class. And so, as a consequence, both parties abandoned so much of the country. Now, one of the great examples of that is found in the aftermath of the recession. So the great recession. Here's an example where most of the economic hardship that was rained on America by the corporate elite and Wall Street was, in fact, not only were these companies bailed out, but nobody was held accountable for the fact that Main Street was so poorly affected, was so tragically affected. Many people lost their homes, went upside down on their mortgages, and yet the corporate elite and financial interests got away unscathed. So I think the message from 2008 and 2009 and its aftermath was that, you know, Americans who played by the rules and worked really hard got no bailout. But those that were cheating the system and ripping everyone off did. And so I think it further alienated the working classes in America from and made them realize that neither party had their interests in mind. This also became quite illustrated by some of the comments that, whether it was, you know, Hillary Clinton's deplorables or Mitt Romney's 47% of the country are takers, they felt disdained by the elite classes, both Republicans and Democrats. And Trump's brilliance in terms of his ability to sense this was understanding that rage and making the elite classes the demon, being able to kind of tap into it and tell people that had felt forgotten, people who had sat out the last couple of presidential elections because they felt that neither Obama nor McCain spoke to them, nor Romney. So they weren't involved, really. They stopped voting. Trump tapped into that in a way that the media elite completely missed, and that was so powerful, because not only did he recognize their hurt, but he made their disdain for the elite okay. He gave them license to be able to disdain those classes of society that had mocked them for so long. So there was almost a kind of a revenge or a revanchism that Trump tapped into by saying, you know, you forgotten Americans will be forgotten no longer. And that was both working class people, it was rural Americans, it was Christian Americans that felt Christianity was under attack. So there were many social and economic factors that made many Americans feel rejected by their own country, and that Trump so effectively tapped into.
Now, you know, I thought that that was a thoughtful analysis. And as I was reading through that, I kept thinking to myself, well, couldn't the same thing kind of be said a little bit about kind of Bernie Sanders and his movement, that it's tapping into maybe a similar elite ignoring us? And ultimately, I mean, one of the things it seems that you're arguing is that maybe that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, they're right in the sense that they're right that who is getting harmed in a sense. Now, probably not the Christian group that you were bringing up in terms of Trump, not all of the alienating groups, but at least in the economic sense that Bernie and Trump are right. Now, although you don't ever seem to go in that direction, I mean, is part of kind of what you're getting at when you get later in the book, an idea that we need to kind of eschew trade and globalization for workers here. You never kind of seemed to. I was just curious about that. You never kind of seemed to put a bow on that, at least for me. Maybe I missed that. So I was curious about your argument there.
Well, first of all, there's definitely I definitely speak in the book about how Trump and Sanders were flip sides to the same coin. I mean, mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a lot of research that says that when you discussions with former auto workers and other manufacturing industry participants showed that in the build up to 16, they were considering Trump and Sanders, but rejecting all the mainstream candidates. So there's no question that Trump's populism and Bernie Sanders, the 1%, they were elements of the same theme. Now, to your second question about prescriptions, I think there's a combination of things that need to be done that will especially affect those that have been left behind economically. And that's about providing for the government playing a role to provide more what I would call pre-distribution access to resources, whether it's education or whether it's asset ownership, that that all Americans should benefit from. So, you know, obviously, whenever we get into the classic discussions of public policy related to equity, we talk about redistribution, taxation, and there's no question that I think there's some truth to that. Our tax system has become too regressive, so I think there probably is some solution that involves taxation, increasing certain taxes, and redistributing that money for worker training and education. I think that's all true. But I also think there are other ways to get at this problem that include much more access to early life opportunities and training, education, that creates different investments for public goods like infrastructure and like information superhighways that can provide information to a broader array of Americans. So I do talk in the end of the book about some prescriptive elements. I think the prescriptions, Trey, to resolve this incredible need for access to opportunity across all Americans is not only things like some redistribution, which I think is merited given how regressive our tax system has been, but also pre-distributive efforts like much, much better access to education at earlier stages in life, but even at work training later in life. If you look at other democratic republics like Germany, they spend a lot more time investing in worker training for industries that have displaced workers and providing them new skills. So I think these pre-distributive mechanisms can be very important in redressing some of the inequities that have been built up in society and that we've allowed to go to an extreme in America. One example that I mentioned in the book is the baby bonds program, which has been quite researched by think tanks, that shows that the government allowing for an accrual of an investment that's set aside at birth and can be used for education or starting a business is economically quite interesting and quite attractive and is not that costly. And, asset ownership is something that generally both Republicans and Democrats can get behind, as is things like infrastructure investment. So I do believe there are prescriptions that can address the problem we're talking about of so much of rural America left behind.
Now, another part of the prescription, and I guess in the prescription, sometimes I guess sometimes in your prescriptions, I felt a little bit shorted. I'm just curious about that. And one of them where that was the case was, and again, this is kind of focusing on my area of communication. You talk about how in modern America, we this problem of the modern media, including you mentioned the recently ended Rush Limbaugh show. And a number of times I loved your little quips about how, look, it doesn't matter how many times we shout on Twitter, it's not going to fix anything. I love and I appreciate that. And I think you're right. Earlier in your answers, you were even talking about that relationship, how people interact in person is so fundamentally different from the way that we're going to engage online. As a matter of fact, when I first started my academic career, Seth, I'll never forget when I had to put my own research into work. I just had some of the, it was the first time I was teaching online, and I just had some of the nastiest student interactions I had ever experienced. And I couldn't figure out why in this online class, why did all the nasty people just take the online class? And when I kind of applied the research of my own political communication area, what I kind of realized was I was just this kind of impersonal thing. And so we created some videos and did other things. They almost kind of got to meet me. And man, did that ever change the way that students interacted, right? A lot of that nasty went away because it wasn't exactly being in person, but I wasn't just a faceless machine anymore. And so you talk about that in the book. So, but I guess my question though is, you know, in this era, in the communication era that we find ourselves, and we can't be rational on Twitter, as you rightfully point out, it's difficult to be rational in the modern American communication because it's all about audience. But if everybody wants to listen to talking heads yell at each other, and if everybody talks on Twitter, how do we get to the rational if that's where everybody is in a communication sense?
I think it's a great question and one that I've thought a lot about. Well, and there's two directions that I think are important to mention. The first one is that, you know, free information and dissemination of objective truth is a public good in a classic economic sense, meaning that it's like parks and roads, meaning like when consumption of it by one person doesn't decrease the availability to someone else. It's available to be joined by an unlimited supply, a limitless amount of consumers without depleting its power. And at the same time, because it's a public good, it's something that industries or businesses alone won't adequately invest in, which is why the government has a role in a classic economics definition. So the reason why I mention this is if you go back to before Reagan deregulated the news in the U.S., one of the requirements was that airwaves, which were publicly owned, that people who broadcast on airwaves, companies that did, had to provide access to rational points of view on both sides, and that was a requirement of news. Of course, that went away with deregulation in the 80s. But and I'm not saying that we should go back to that. But I think it's important to start the conversation or the answer to your question by recognizing that public information, that information flow and a sharing of objective truth is a public good, and we need to foster it. Now, then the question becomes, can we do it without government regulation or with the least amount of government regulation possible? And I think, or so said another way, are there ways for the private sector to be motivated in a different way, incentivized in a different way than we are today, which is a system which motivates, I would argue, attention, screaming, regardless of merit, you know, whether it's true or not. And I think there are ways that private interests can create a better mousetrap that might have different incentives. Let me give a few examples. You know, we talk ad nauseum about Twitter and Facebook and these platforms. And in some ways, these platforms are enormously powerful in the way they decentralize or democratize voice. In other words, anyone can contribute. And that's great. But one of the things that they also do is they create anonymity, which might not be as healthy. In other words, people, when you're on Facebook or Twitter, you never know if the person who's espousing something is a real person or is a bot in Moscow or some other, you know, fake persona that's been created by a nefarious forces at work or people trying to influence through you know, non-authentic premises. So I think one of the interesting questions is, would simply imagine a business idea of creating a social platform where authentication is a requirement for entry. Just like today, when you want to drive, you have to give a driver's license. It, on this new social platform, if you want to participate, you have to be authenticated as a real human being and not as some
a new kind of check mark. Yes, this is a person.
This is a real person. Because I think so, half a good part of the problem is the anonymity that let's use a parallel for a second and talk about our constitution of knowledge. You know, one of the most powerful elements of what is true as what we think is true is today is comes from this process we have of augmenting our quote unquote constitution of knowledge. How do we do it? Well, we have a very wide funnel. Anyone could pitch ideas into the constitution of knowledge, but those ideas are because of specialization and expertise and they get peer reviewed and they get criticized and proven untrue. And only when something, it may have entered a wide funnel in this knowledge constitution, but only if it can go through the rigor of review and critique could it come out the other side as something accepted as true, like the earth is round or, you know, whatever truth you may have. So my point being is that in social media and in media in general, we have a wide funnel is okay, but we have to figure out a way to get better at validating what's really true and not through some form of decentralized peer review. So I think one way of doing that is through authentication. And imagine a social media platform which has authenticated users only. And then imagine an incentive system that incentivizes not only loudness or screaming or one who gets the most points of view that are backed by fact. Now, that becomes tricky because who's the arbiter of what's factual or not? So I recognize these are not easy things to achieve, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to create interaction platforms in the digital space and in media in general that have better authentication of real people and that have some incentive system to be based on truth. Now, I think there may also be some role for regulation. I mean, it may be that government does have a role to play in ensuring some of these things. But my overall point being is that I think it is definitely true that the digital space can be very harsh and very bitter because of anonymity. And we ultimately will need to have more personal interaction regardless of what happens to media. But I think media also has to evolve. And we need some better incentive systems in both broadcast media and digital media. I think the closest that we get to a more balanced approach is in print media. Of course, it's easier with long form print. In fact, one of the things I argue in the book is that if we can't agree on a way of better regulating political advertising because it's so out of control, we should ban it entirely except for print. We should allow politicians to make their case in print and let people read their points of view.
It's very similar to the argument that Neil Postman made in Amusing Ourselves to Death, where there's something just so fundamentally different about having to read or having that print. I can understand that, Seth. Now, you know, you have thankfully been with us a long time on the show. I really appreciate all of your time. But before we finish, I did want to give you last opportunity for everybody who listens or everybody who reads your book. If they're going to take away something, what for you is the thing? I want everybody who has read this book, this is what I'd want them to leave with.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. What would that be, Seth?
Great. I love this question, Trey, and I was hoping that you would ask it. So the book seems to point out this schism between the moderate and radical enlightenment we were talking about earlier. And, you know, as if like one side is right and that understanding the differences is really important, which I think it is. But there's another schism outside of the moderate radical. And that's the schism between enlightenment overall and unreason. So what I want people to take away from the book is whatever their political ideology is, whether it's more moderate conservative or liberal, as if your argument is based in reason and fact and observation, I think it's valid. And what we should reject is not moderate or radical enlightenment philosophies. They both have validity, and they both have contributed to our heritage as Americans. What we need to reject is complete unreason. We need to re-inject a respectful, reasonable civic discourse by rejecting complete counter-Enlightenment approaches that don't allow for our Enlightenment inheritance of reason and rationality. So that's what I hope people will take away, that in our modern society, the Enlightenment is not a bad word. It's our inheritance. Our heritage from that era is about having a respectful dialogue. And a democracy thrives on divergent views. And the U.S. always has thrived on divergent views. But if we reject truth altogether, democracy as a form of government is doomed. And we will not be able to pass on our democratic institutions to the next generation. Trey, you asked me what I want you readers to take away from the book. And one of the most important lessons is that it's not so much the moderate versus radical schism that we need to focus on, but it's that we need to embrace reason and rationality against the notion of counter-Enlightenment thought that rejects those things, so that our democracy has always thrived on divergent views on how the U.S. should be run. And it will continue to thrive if we have a good discussion of different political views. But if we reject objective truth altogether, democracy as a form of government is doomed, and we will not be able to pass it on to the next generation. And I think, for example, this podcast about the politics guys is a great example of part of what is part of the solution, a forum to discuss these things in a little bit more depth with a little bit more reason and discussion than you would typically see on many forms of media. So I applaud what you guys are doing here to help fight unreason with reason.
That's a potent point. Seth, thank you so much for joining me on the Politics Guys.
This has been so great, Trey. Thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, listeners, I want to say again, we have been talking with Seth David Radwell. The book we've been discussing is American Schism, and it comes out on June 29th, published by Greenleaf Book Group Press. Thanks again, Seth. Politics Guys listeners, thank you guys so much for listening to this show. We hope that maybe that we're a little bit of the answer to Seth's yes. schism, that we're hitting on that. So Seth, I hope that we maybe inspire, say, maybe there's a little bit out there who's trying to kind of talk into that media. And I would ask listeners, if you're listening to the show, as you know, thank you guys so much. This is a labor of love. You know, we don't do it for any other reason than you guys. And we would love for you all to be supporters of the show, because that's what makes this kind of longer form media possible. And you get benefits for doing that. As you guys know, supporters have the opportunity to talk with Mike and Ken and myself and others on our Discord channel. And you can gain that by becoming a supporter. If you want to become a supporter, all you have to do is check out the Politics Guys Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can go to politicsguys.com/support. And you can join me again on a future show, again, by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you'd like to share about the interview, please, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on the dreaded Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Nathan Solnowski, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkinson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. I hope you'll join us next time.